We're going to be talking with two people whose voices were very, very familiar to radio listeners for a period of, well, about 10 years on one show, and whose voices cropped up all over the place during the good old days of radio and since then, too. Our guests are Janet Waldo and Sam Edwards. And Janet Waldo, you were who on radio?
Well, I guess I will be remembered best for having played the role of Corliss Archer on a program by F.U. Herbert called Meet Corliss Archer.
And that was based on Junior Miss, right?
No! F.U. Herbert would never be happy to hear you say that. It was based on the daughters of F.U. Herbert. He wrote the series about his two girls who were then teenagers, and let's put it this way, Junior Miss was based on Corliss Archer.
All right.
I don't know. They were all original. Date with Judy, Junior Miss, and Corliss Archer were all about typical American teenage girls. And F.U. Herbert wrote a stage play called Kiss and Tell, which starred Joan Caulfield. It was her first introduction into the theater. And then the series came from that.
Okay, so now we have Corliss Archer. And wherever Corliss Archer was, we had Dexter Franklin.
Right.
And so we have Dexter Franklin. Sam Edwards. Let's hear that famous voice.
Holy cow!
Oh, those were the days. Is this the first time you folks have gotten together and since the program went off the radio?
Oh, no.
We
work together all the time.
And, we get together as often as we
commercials.
Can.
Commercials. In fact, they team us every now and then in a radio spot.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We have the same commercial agent, Jack Worms.
Right.
And I don't think Jan and I have ever worked in a movie together, though, have we?
No, how come, Sammy?
I don't know.
We got to talk to somebody. Yeah. Besides, you do a great Jimmy Cagney. Why haven't they had you do that?
Corliss Archer hit radio in 1943. For the first time. And Janet,
that's
were
what
you,
they say.
Were you with those old days? Were you with, were you Corliss at the very beginning?
I wasn't the very original Corliss Archer. A girl by the name of Priscilla Lyon played it first. And then I came in very shortly after it was on the air. So I have played it. I played it for the full 10 years, which I whisper.
Well, you don't have to worry. You are still America's teenager.
Oh, well. Right. Well, actually, we do still, Sammy and I both still do the voices of teenagers in cartoons, and we love it.
Old men.
The old men. Teenagers, old men, old women.
Is that
children,
is that where
dogs?
The radio business, all the radio actors now are finding good work in the cartoon industry?
Oh, a lot of them are.
A lot of them are.
Some of your best voice people are ex-radio performers.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I must say, it is true that a lot of radio people are into cartoons because cartoonery is sort of a glorified radio. It really is very similar to radio, except just more bigger. More
and doing a lot of radio spots, too, you know, radio. Mm-hmm.
Radio spots.
Commercials, yeah.
But I have to make a point, which I'm very proud of, which is that many, many radio people, Sammy will bear this out with me, most radio people, because they were very well trained in radio, have gone on to television and motion pictures. And I mean, when you say, are radio people hiding in cartoons? No. Bill Conrad has his own series.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I mean, there's some, they are marvelous people from
most
radio.
Most of them have been very successful in the visual medium, and some of them even have gone on to nightclubs and nearly everyone I know has done very well.
That's right. Hardly any of them have just
they made the transition very easily.
Sam, was Corliss Archer your first radio job?
Oh, no. I started my first year in junior high school in San Antonio, Texas. My dad and mother had been dramatic stage stars. They had their own company for years, and they started in radio when dramatic stock went out. And so they had a radio show there called The Adventures of Sonny and Buddy, which my mother wrote, and my brother and I played the kids in it, and mother played the girl, and dad played all the men's parts. So we used to sing on the show. It was about a medicine show traveling around and so forth. And it was one of the first radio adventure series. And that brought our family out to Hollywood. And we recorded. First, we were in San Diego for a year and a half for the Kramer Baking Company down there doing the show live. And we had gone from San Antonio to Shreveport, Louisiana, for 3 months in the summer. And then we came to Hollywood, or rather to San Diego. We were there for a year and a half and recorded 100 episodes of this up at RCA Victor. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the first recorded kids shows. It was syndicated all over the United States. So had a lot of Warner Brothers songs on it. And they had a band on their music. So we would have been quite well-to-do at that particular time, and had it not been for the fact that the Warner Brothers songs were on most of these shows, and the sponsors canceled them right and left, and my father lost everything. We were just completely broke. And Jack and I were trying to continue going to school, and, you know, we would have been very wealthy people. But that wasn't in the cards, so we starved to death in Hollywood until we got started.
Well, how did you get started? What was your first job after that?
Gosh, I would sing in on stage at amateur contests for $2 a night. Mm-hmm. And try to go to school, and Jack was going to school, and I went to junior college then finally when I graduated, and studied law for a couple of years, and
didn't
like that, and I had to go to work. Then I went out with a road show. Oh, I don't know. This darn many things have happened. It's hard to keep up with them.
Gee, I'm finding out things about Dexter Franklin I never knew.
But actually, we started radio, network radio, I think up in San Francisco. We went up there.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, Dad and Mother had not a dime. I mean, they had an old beat-up automobile that would hardly run, and the tires would blow out, and they'd manage to get a second-hand one. And we got up there, and they were so broke. It was really terrible. And we auditioned at NBC, and they had their own casting service up there. And we were, you know, treated as what should we call squatters when we first went up. They didn't want any part of us. But gradually, we'd get a little part here, a little in there, and finally, we began to be able to make a living. But we were working, you know, $7 a show, $15 a show, and then we worked at KFRC in San Francisco. And it just started very, very slowly, getting parts, bit parts at first, and then finally we got our own show, The Edwards Family, and I got into One Man's Family. My brother won the first audition. We both auditioned against each other, and he got the part first. And the following year, Carlton Morse cast me as a character, and I was in that for about 4 or 5 years.
What was the character?
The character was Tracy Baker. Uh-huh. He was been an ex-reform school kid that was adopted by Nikki Lacey, and Jack played Wayne Grubb, Teddy's boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So I was drafted into the service a couple of years after the war broke out, and Jack had TB of the spine when he was a child, so he was a 4F. He had, you know, back, still got a scar that long. But, so he played Wayne Grubb until One Man's Family went off the air. And, so we were commuting back and forth, you know, Hollywood to San Francisco. I don't know, things just, from then on, it started rolling, and we've done very well since.
Don't you really think
I'm
that
sorry to
playing
take up so
Dexter
much time.
Franklin did the whole switch for you?
Well,
don't you think that really brought you into your own?
It probably did, because when I got back from the service, I thought, oh, boy, I'll never be able to get started again. You know, I felt like that my career was behind me. And Jack insisted, my brother, he'd heard about this audition for Corliss. And I said, oh, I can't play a teenager, and for heaven's sakes, I've been in the Army, you know, and my attitude is completely different. And he said, go down and do it. I said, I can't. So he called up Jimmy Sathier and made an appointment for me to go down there. And I had known Janet, and I was, you know, delighted to see her again, and I didn't think I had a Chinaman's chance
But you were great.
I won the audition.
Yeah. You know who also auditioned with you and talks about it a lot is Jay Stewart, who came in second.
Yeah.
Says,
oh, he did? I didn't know that.
He says that, but we know that Dexter, there was only one Dexter, and it was Sammy Edwards.
Janet Waldo, where did you get your first start in radio? Was it radio, or you
yes.
were in another
well,
area of show business before
well,
that?
Well, I did a lot of... Oh, gosh. Well, actually, let's say it was radio. I did some little theater, and I did some other things before radio, but the first radio show that I was on, actually, was Lux Radio Theater, and I played a bit on that, and I worked with Jerry Hausner and Hans Conried, who are very well-known radio people and have gone on to television, and I remember thinking, gee, this must be a crazy business because Hans Conried had one green sock on and one red sock.
I remember
and,
that.
And Jerry Hausner kept teasing me about taking, he said, you know, they're getting younger every day coming into radio. They're taking jobs away from men with families. And it took me about 2 weeks before I realized that a man with a family couldn't have played my part, you know. But, I mean, I thought, gee, everybody in radio is crazy. And then I realized after I worked in radio that there's no medium as wonderful as radio. I think the people in radio excel people in any other medium. It was kind of like a big family, wasn't it, Sam?
Yes, it was.
And I don't blame there being nostalgia for radio because it was a wonderful era. Mm-hmm. Dinah Shore used to say that, isn't it too bad that radio came before television? It would have been so much better if television had come first.
Yes.
And then radio, because then we could all relax, you know, and enjoy ourselves. Radio was a fun, marvelous medium.
Yes,
wasn't
it was. And there was one thing about it. You had to be able to cut it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything was in the voice. And if you couldn't read lines, yeah, well, you just...
It was not easy. I mean, you could just anybody couldn't do radio. You had to be a very quick study. And in fact, I think it's too bad now that the young kids don't have the opportunity of working in radio.
It was a great training ground.
Because mm-hmm. it was so mm-hmm. great as a training ground. I mean, we worked in front of audiences. We had a sense of comedy timing. You know, the audiences would tell us. We had to be such quick studies. We had to be able to pick up a script. I remember one time I got a call for a Silver Theater, and the actress who had played the starring role opposite Kirk Douglas had panicked. She was in pictures, and she was a foreign actor. She had an accent, and so she was very insecure about having, you know, to do mm-hmm. it with so mm-hmm. little rehearsal. And they called me, and I had to go and be there and on the air within about 20 minutes and, you know, read it cold. And it was a great challenge, but it was very exciting.
Well, you remember the time when Bob Crosby was on the show, and he forgot about the second show, and we were about to go on the air, and he was not there, and here comes Gil Stratton marching down the hall, and they grabbed Gil by the back of the neck and said, come here, and they stuck a script in his hand, and he's on the air, and he played the part.
That's the second broadcast for the West Coast, or whatever.
The East Coast.
There was a great danger in missing these sometimes, and Ed Begley did it one time. He came in, and he'd forgotten, and he was over at Nick Adell's restaurant, and all of a sudden, he realized that he was on the air in 4 or 5 minutes, and he came racing into the studio, and he got so balled up on his script, he picked up the script, and he had a horse story, I'll remember. This was for Dr. Christian. And the horse was named Godaw Bool. And he picked up, and he started to come to this line, and he says, and what happened to Godaw Bool? Godaw Bool, and he never did get it out.
But live radio, of course, very shortly after we were in radio, they came into tape. We did a lot of years of taping, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. But the live radio had a special excitement about it that it just couldn't be surpassed.
Felt like a first night.
In fact, my husband, Bob Lee, one time was doing a Jack Benny show in New York, and he tells me that he forgot about the East Coast. And he went to a movie, and he had the scripts. He was not the actor, and, you know, he was the assistant director, and he was responsible for the scripts. And he was sitting in this movie, you know, thinking, and then he realized 5 minutes before airtime, and poor Jack Benny and all of the people waiting for him to come with a script. Very, very scary, but an exciting time.
But those were days where people really got involved in the stuff, and they really came through with
That's
it, didn't
right.
They?
I think the adrenaline was the excitement. Everything was just at a higher pitch, and it was just marvelous, a marvelous feeling. I don't know about you, Sammy, but I remember not being able to wait to get on, especially with
If it's something especially that you enjoy.
You were so excited about it. I did a character called Emmy Lou on the Ozzie and Harriet mm-hmm, show, mm-hmm. and she was a little teenager who lived next door, and I was just a cameo, a spot in it. I came on the first spot after the first act break, and I just stand in the wings and not be able to wait until it was time for me to get on. I just love doing it.
Well, I love Dexter because it was one of the few times I got to do comedy. Most of the time I was playing nasty little heavies or something, usually the bad guy, or once in a while the good guy, but on Dragnets and Dr. Christian was different, but so many of the shows I played, heavies.
But it's so interesting to me because I really didn't know you as far as playing heavies was concerned.
No.
And I knew you as, and Even now, when I see you, Sammy, on television doing a heavy, I look at you and I say, ah, he can't fool me. That's Dexter Bryant. Because the real, you know, you have kind of a marvelous quality that is very Dexter, which is very, if you'll pardon me, Sammy, kind of bumbling and lovable.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But it's I knew you would.
You know, there are certain roles like that that come along that it really appears that only one person can really do it. And you were not the first Corliss, and Sam, you weren't
the
first
Dexter. No, I was about third Dexter. Yeah.
But still, you know, there you were. You had the role. It's like Richard Crenna on the Armis Brooks series. He was always the... I can't think of the name of that.
He had a tough time also getting out of the teenage type thing. And in fact, Dick Crenna and I did a Lucy show where we played teenagers, and I was 5 months pregnant at the time.
Oh, that's right.
And
modern teenager.
Yeah, but this was some years ago. My son is quite grown. But the only thing is, they're still playing that. They're still rerunning that Lucy show, and my son's friends all say, hey, John, you're on TV again. Come look. Because they're still playing all those old Lucy.
I know. My daughter was looking at it last night, or yesterday afternoon, and was the ones with the Desi.
Unfortunately, they're not replaying some of our Corliss shows, but I think they will. You're
sooner
planning
later,
to, I
We're
hope.
Going to play one, yeah, right. Did, you never did Corliss Archer on television, did you?
Yes, it was on television. We didn't do it.
No, we didn't.
No, you didn't.
But it was on for just a few weeks, and I have a happy, sad feeling to tell. It was not very successful.
Why was it?
I don't know. It just wasn't as good as the radio show. We all.
I'll tell you why, because, you see, everybody who listened to Corliss Archer and Dexter Franklin had their own idea of what those two teenagers looked like.
That's right.
And then when it went to television, what did we see but somebody else's idea?
That's right.
And
even the movie,
can't replace it.
Shirley Temple and Jerome Cortland played it in pictures, and it was not a very successful movie.
No, it was
Kiss
an
and Tell.
Entirely different feel.
But the radio show was very successful.
Oh, it was super. Well, listen, a radio show in those days lasted for 10 years, and yours did. I know. It went on in the 50s.
And it amazes me because, to tell you the truth, I never thought that it would be a real, you know, a very joyful thing to be a part of history, particularly. I mean, I never really thought, you know, that's something I really can't wait to be. But it's kind of exciting because I truly used to keep it quiet that I played Corliss Archer in radio because I thought, you know, who wants an old Corliss Archer?
Oh,
but
silly.
The only thing is that now
she
there's
still
such
looks 15.
She does,
there's such an excitement about radio and the nostalgic feeling about radio. And even now when I go to New York and, you know, I don't know where they come from, but those autograph people, you know, who are outside of Sardi's in New York, they always come and say, hey, you know, you did Corliss Archer. Can I have your autograph? And they remember radio.
There's only one thing I don't like, though, Jen. When you meet somebody that, you know, usually they're from out of town, and they're 65 years old, and they say, hey, I used to listen to you when I was a kid. You know, I used to listen to Dick. No, I've had this happen.
Oh, well, listen.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've discovered something, because I've been doing a lot of personal appearances in regard to Corliss and radio and nostalgia and everything, and I have been so amused at some of the people who come up, you know, the old people, and you say, oh, do you remember radio? And they say, oh, yes, well, I don't remember it too well, but my mother, she's 90. She really remembers it. But the people who remember our show are really middle-aged people because they were fans. You see, being a teenage show, they are the younger ones, the younger, older ones, because they as teenagers, they grew up with our show. So now they're not so very old.
Well, I hate to admit this. My wife is 15 years younger than I am, and she used to listen to Corliss
Archer. Well, then you have it, and she's a young woman. So this is the group that we appeal to, which is very gratifying.
Well,
you know?
It even goes younger than that, because the teenage shows were not awfully realistic to teenagers. They were more appealing, I think, to the preteens set in the early teens, because they always wanted to be teen. I mean, these shows were appealing to everybody, but a teenager, a 17-year-old kid listening to Corliss Archer and Dexter say, gee, that's too... I, you know, they'd laugh at it, but it's not real for them. But you see, a kid who's 12 years old says, wow, that's going to be teenage. See? So now you're getting, was 25 years ago, so you got a 12-year-old who was listening
and
then.
And the thing is, he isn't so very
old. He's not so
old.
And the parents could relate to it, too, because a lot of them had characters just like that. As a matter of fact, my stepson he's 16 now, and he's 6 feet one, and I tell you, he's a combination of Dexter and Alvin. He's just everything, he knocks over everything. He's so awkward, and he reminds me very much of Dexter.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, I worked with the cutest black girl the other day, not the other day, a couple of months ago, in an industrial film, and her name is Corliss. And
is
her mother,
right?
And she could hardly stand it to think that I was her namesake, and I had played the role of Corliss Archer, and her parents named her Corliss. Oh, she was cute, really darling black girl. So you see, isn't that nice?
That is nice.
What was the impact of the Corliss Archer on the public? I mean, now you would go to a radio studio every week, and you would do your show. And then what kind of feedback did you get? What did you get from the fans, from the listeners? Were people waiting for you?
Well, we had fan clubs, yes.
We had fan clubs. We got mail.
Lots of mail.
We had marvelous audiences. Of course, during the war, actually, in 1945, we had a lot of sailors, which was marvelous. We had good audiences, servicemen, and the reaction was warm and enthusiastic, and they were indulgent, and they loved Dexter's howl, you know, and they were familiar with the characters enough so that they knew what to expect, and they loved it when they heard it, you know. I think that it was
I remember one time we went to Yakima, Washington,
your hometown
on a personal appearance tour, and we were in a parade. They had an old Model T Ford rigged up for us, and oh, the townspeople were just marvelous, you know. They just great. We were treated like big celebrities.
It was a typical American family, and I think the American families enjoyed listening to it. And Irene Tedrow, who played the mother on Corliss Archer, is still very much with us. We all work together, and she is a very lovely and marvelous actress and does a lot of TV and has done theater a lot with Henry Fonda. She played in Our Town recently with Henry Fonda. And she's just a wonderful person, and we've maintained our closeness to her.
Yes.
Each of you did lots of other radio work. Sam said you were on the Dragnet shows and on the radio Dragnet, and you've done lots of television too.
Oh yeah, right? I did the first Dragnet TV film. You know,
the
pilot film.
The pilot?
Mm-hmm.
What was this story about?
Well, that was a story about the bomb that was planted in the City Hall. I was in prison, and my brother was trying to get me out of prison, and he had a bomb, and this was played by Stacey Harris, who passed away a couple of years ago.
Another big radio.
Yeah, Ray Burr was in it. Ray sort of helped with the direction of it, but we shot it down at the City Hall, way up on the fourth floor. We started on Friday afternoon after everyone went home to work, and we were still there Monday morning, hadn't gone home, and we were still there shooting when they started coming to work. And most of it had to be shot over again in a studio, in Sam Goldwyn's studios, because Jack Webb, when he saw the dailies, suddenly realized that he had a lot of master shots and that this was going to be on a 12.5-inch screen, and he needed some close-ups. And the acoustics were terrible up there. Everything bounced off of the walls, and there was no room for the camera to maneuver. So they had to build a set then, and 3 or 4 weeks later we went back and did some additional scenes for it. But we all worked for $100 for the entire picture, including Raymond Burr. 4 days on this thing for $100. But Jack Webb had to go into hock in order to raise the money. I think he said NBC had given him a $30,000 budget, and it cost $41,000. So he had to mortgage his house and use his own money. But since it's paid off, of course.
Yeah.
But
he was pretty successful with Dragnet on radio.
Jack is a very successful man, and I have to take my hat off to him. He knows what he wants. He met a lot of resistance in trying to sell this idea, but he felt that it would go, and it did. Mm-hmm. And, it's one of the most successful radio and TV shows ever produced.
You both worked the Lux Radio Theater many times.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
And
I
worked
Hallmark.
I worked Railroad Hour a lot. Mm-hmm. And Favorite Story, which was where I met my husband, who he and his partner, Jerry Lawrence, were... Did you ever work Favorite Stories?
I worked it one time, and Bob said that was the greatest show that he'd ever done, and I've never worked for him since.
Oh, well, listen, I married him, and I've never worked for him.
No,
Well, your husband is Robert E. Lee.
Right.
And he is
of Lawrence and Lee.
Of Lawrence and Lee, right.
And they're playwrights, really. But they did do radio, and favorite story, they did classics. They did some marvelous things. In fact, I got to play Roxanne opposite Ronald Coleman on that, and I did a lot of marvelous, I was given a lot of marvelous roles in that. It was an acting challenge for most people in Hollywood. You know, we all liked to work that show because it was, we had a chance to really emote. And let's see, I did, I worked with Orson Welles on the Orson Welles Show, which was quite an experience. He was...
Shut off your grandfather's clock.
Oh, yes. How do you like that? I inherited
hey,
that.
That's beautiful.
And,
nice
oh,
folksy
hush clock.
Scene here. That's all right. Always, we're still watching the clock with radio today.
Even know
right?
what time it is.
Excuse me for interrupting.
That's all right, but that clock did before you did. And I did the Eddie Bracken Show for a while. I worked with Eddie Bracken. And we all were, and of course, Ozzie and Harriet, which I loved doing. I did that for several years.
That was a pretty regular spot on there.
Yeah, it was every week.
Uh-huh.
And then
uh-huh.
I even did it on television for 3 years after it went on television. I did the same character on television, and then I finally started playing the neighbor ladies, you know.
Did you do any soaps?
Oh, yes, I did lots of soap operas. Didn't you, Sam?
Oh, yeah, I did several. I did, well, One Man's Family.
I did One Man's Family, too.
That's right.
I did Irene on One Man's Family for a couple
but
of
years. But I did
Everybody's
here.
Worked on One Man's Family.
Oh, that was
Dr.
a large
Paul.
Family.
Yeah,
Woman in My House, I think that was D.C.
Did you do, you did Aunt Mary, too, would you?
No, I didn't do Aunt Mary. Jack, my brother did Aunt Mary.
I did Aunt Mary.
No, I did Woman in My House, which was more or less replays of One Man's Family scripts.
Yeah. Well, you did Guiding Light.
I did a few Guiding Lights, but I did Dr. Paul, which was a West Coast show, and Dr. Kate up in San Francisco when I was there, and a show called Hawthorne House. I did that for a while after Eddie Firestone went to Chicago to do The Brewster Boy.
You did The Brewster Boy?
No, Eddie Firestone.
Eddie Firestone, yeah.
Eddie was doing the part, he was doing Hawthorne House on the West Coast in San Francisco, and he got this chance to go to Chicago to do the Brewster Boy, so he left, and I was working up there. We worked together on so many shows, and so I was cast in his part for a while until I was drafted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had a Western up there, a Western show, which my dad wrote called Sons of the Lone Star, which was Eddie and I played the two leads in it.
And Sammy, was it Screen Guild Theater, which had so many guests?
Yes.
Because I remember working with Bob Hope, but I can't remember what the name of the show
was. It was Screen Guild.
Screen Guild. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, in Screen Guild Theater, we worked with so many marvelously talented people, and I loved working with Bob Hope, and I remember we had to make so many more cuts in the script, on the air even, you know, with Bob Hope, because he got so many laughs that were not expected.
It took all the time, huh?
Yeah. And I worked with Abbott and Costello, actually. Which was, I was amazed. I remember I was so fascinated watching Costello get a laugh. He had warned the audience, but I hadn't heard it in the warm-up, that when he wanted them to laugh more, he was going to jiggle his pants. He was going to, and I missed a cue because I couldn't figure out what he was doing. And, you know, because I was supposed to come in with my line, and there he was, you know, with the pant leg. He was making it go back and forth, and then the audience would laugh and scream.
Oh, they were great.
They had, Bob Hope, I remember, this marvelous, resounding laughter that you would hear after some of the anything that you said on the Bob Hope Show got a huge laugh because he just electrified the air.
Yes, he did.
He was just fabulous to work
Still
with.
Still does. He just
and I remember working
marvelous.
With Claudette Colbert one time, and I had on a suit exactly the same color as a suit she had on. And, of course, audience shows, you know, and I was so mortified. I was, you know, thinking if I had time, I'd go home and change. But she was so sweet about it. She would say, oh, relax. Forget it. It's just radio. Who notices? Just those few people out there. But it was fun.
Did you ever have any monumental flubs or bloopers or real bad problems?
I had a few. Did you have any favorite ones, Sammy, that you... I remember...
Yes. I'm trying to think. There was one in particular. What was it? I almost ruined the whole plot because...
Oh, that's always lovely.
I said it was the wrong time or something. I can't recall exactly what it was. And I wasn't even aware that I had made this mistake. And I kept going, and you had the funniest expression on your face. Everybody did. And everybody was looking at me wide-eyed, and I thought, what's the matter with these people, you know? And I had said something. I can't recall what it was. Maybe I'll think about it later. And finally... The producer, I think it was Helen Mack at that time, the director, came out while we were still on the air And she handed me a sheet that comes up on three or four pages later, and she had a line that says, well, I meant to say so-and-so, but what I said was so-and-so. Or I said so-and-so, but what I meant was so-and-so.
Oh, you know, that
don't you remember that?
Yes, I do, and it reminded me also.
And I didn't, I thought, what's the matter? I didn't even realize I had said it.
Oh, that's so, well, you know, I used to wear roses or camellias or something in my hair. Do you remember that? I'd always,
oh, yes.
And it's coming back. The style is coming back. But, you know, I just, this was a thing that I did. And one time, I had a rose in my hair, and everybody was kind of watching me and being very careful, and I did not realize why, but there was a measuring worm on the rose, and it was coming out and, you know, just reaching over and almost kissing me on the cheek, and they knew, because I'm so frightened of bugs or anything. And of course, as soon as we were off the air, they said, you know, there's a worm in that rose, and I let out the shriek, which they knew I would have done on the air. Also, on Ozzie and Harriet, I was supposed to say, and they were talking about the stock market, and I was supposed to say, oh, you know, hi, Mr. Mel, are you a bull or a bear? But, you know, I didn't know anything about the stock market, and I don't know what, my vision was good, I don't know what the problem was, but I said, hi, Mr. Nelson, are you a bull or a deer? And he said, you know, there was this kind of beat, and then he said, I didn't know what I'd said wrong, and he said, well, Emmy Lou, I'm really a bull, but you can call me deer if you want. But I don't know, and on Corliss, I said one time, I was always Corliss.
I never knew you to make an error on Corliss.
Oh, well, don't you remember the time I had a hanky, and I was always crying into my handkerchief, you know, supposedly, and one time I had to say, my handkerchief is absolutely sopping, and I said, my handkerchief is absolutely sipping. But, it, you know, those are the things that, oh, and we had to say Lake Tehachapuku on Ozzie and Harriet, and I think I once said something that was a little different. And I don't know, there were...
I remember once on Corliss when we were doing it, fortunately we were on tape, and I think it was the last year we were on the air over at ABC, and I was sort of off stage, and I gave the Corliss yell, you know, calling, Corliss, oh, Corliss, and... Suddenly, the father says something, and I'm supposed to then come in. You had a few lines before that, and the audience was laughing, and I was sort of enjoying the show, and all of a sudden, everything stops. And I have the next line. I'm supposed to come in. And I'm sitting there sort of enjoying it all and forgot that I was supposed to come in. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And we stopped, and... Fortunately, we were on tape, so they could do it over again. But I was so embarrassed, I must have turned seven shades of red.
Well, Sammy, you don't remember the time I sat on the Coke bottle, do you?
No, I don't remember.
We had Coke before the show. You can edit. We had Coca-Cola's, you know. And then they brought us in. They introduced us. You know, I had put my Coke bottle on my chair. And so as they introduced us, I just came up, took my bow, and then went to my chair, sat down on the Coke bottle, and there was this crash and spilling all over the floor.
To be a good show because things go better with Coke.
Oh, no. Oh, right. That's very good. They'll send you a Coke.
Well, you don't have to edit that out. But I want to tell you a story that happened to Bea Benaderet on a series I did, which I forgot to tell you about, which was with Jimmy Lydon called Young Love, which was created by my husband and his partner, and was the last time I ever worked for him, because it wasn't a success, but it was on the air. It was about a young couple who were married in college, and as you know, now that wouldn't make history, but yeah. In those days, it was they had to keep their marriage a secret. Because
as a matter of fact,
against,
it might make history.
It had to, you know, it was against the rules of the college campus, so the theme of the show called Young Love was how these two kids who were married were ever going to have any time together because they were, you know, she lived in her dorm and he lived in his dorm. And it was really a very cute show. But Bea Benaderet, you may remember from
sure.
Petticoat Junction and a number of radio shows and television, she was playing a Western heroine. And an actor by the name of Herb Butterfield was playing this very stuffy, you know, stuffy old guy, you know, the principal in the school or something. And she had to come into the office and say, you know, in his office and say, yippee. And he had to say, don't yippee in my office, you know. Well, on the air, for some reason, she said, yippee. And then, of course, he said, don't you pee in my office. Forgive me, audience. If you know that the audience laughed solidly for a minute, and nobody in the cast knew why they were laughing. And we would all look at each other as if to say, well, what in the world is wrong? We didn't get it. Because, you know, we'd rehearsed it. Yeah. Nobody thought it was funny, but it was just the change of inflection, which the difference in a live show, the change of inflection or, you know, timing something, could make all the difference in how the audience reacted.
Did you ever get thrown by a miscue on the part of a sound effects man? Because sometimes they, you know, that old story about the, you know, the guy's going to shoot the gun and the sound
well,
and that,
that's
sleeping, and then
he's going
to give it to you with a knife, and then finally the gun goes.
Yeah, well, the audience
say struck by lightning.
Yeah, the audiences for comedy shows, this would only work for you because the audiences were so with the sound man. The sound man was the star of the show.
Yeah.
Because,
you
know, he would come in, like when Dexter would come in, you know, clumsily and slam the door and everything, the sound man would go, you know, running in and slam the door and stumble all over himself, and the audience just loved that. They loved watching the sound man, and sometimes he would do, you know, like if somebody was panting or if a dog was panting, the sound man would do, you know, and the audience.
No, they were very, very seldom late on their cues, and they really were on the ball.
But it's fun thinking of the things that went wrong, and oh gosh, there have been times it didn't happen to me, or did it? When did the lights go out on Corliss one time, just momentarily? Mm-hmm. And you know, you're reading a script, of course, in radio, and the lights went out, but they went on again very shortly. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it was Corliss or Ozzie and Harriet. And
I don't recall that having happened on Corliss. I know one time I was terrified when we were doing Corliss. One Sunday, I had been working on Operation Pacific with John Wayne, and I was on the thing about 6 weeks. And we were doing a scene where I'm looking into, supposedly I'm on the conning tower of the sub, and we're having a scene, and I was supposed to be from Alabama, called me Junior from Alabama. So they told me to look up into the Klieg lights, or the arcs, and I was not aware that looking into those arc lights, you could almost become blind. You know, they would burn your eyes. And, boy, you know, I wanted to make good because this was the first big part I'd had in movies and well, probably my whole life. I'd had other parts, but this was a big part. And so all day long, this was on a Friday, I remember I was looking up here, and they'd take so long, and I'd stand, and I'd look, and I wouldn't look away. And all of a sudden, I would pick up a piece of paper and everything would disappear. The lines would completely disappear.
Oh, the Klieg lights.
And then they would come back and I didn't know what was wrong. And we started to do the radio show and I'm on the air and I'd see just a blank page.
Oh.
And I'd start to panic and then it would reappear again.
Oh.
And this went on for several days.
That's scary.
I went to a doctor about it and I explained what had happened, and he says, well, he says, it'll pass, but he said, don't ever do that again, because he says you can become blind.
Yeah.
And, but that's the only time, speaking of the lights going out, the page went out.
I got to tell you about an Ozzie and Harriet. You know, I did Corliss and Ozzie and Harriet, teenagers, through two pregnancies, and of course I worked right up until the final moment, because I just couldn't bear to give up playing these roles, which, of course, I adored to
do. She didn't show until 8 and a half months.
Well, I really didn't. And also, it was in the era when the girls could wear petticoats. Uh-huh. So as my tummy would get a little bit bigger, I'd wear another petticoat, and then another petticoat, and then another petticoat. But in the last month, I really showed. I really did. And I was doing an Ozzie and Harriet, and always Ozzie would introduce us, you know, before the show. And he would say, always he would say, and our little teenager next door is played by Miss Janet Waldo, you know? And then I'd come up. Well, this night he said, and it really hurt my feelings because I didn't think I showed. He said, and our teenager, Emmy Lou, will be played by Mrs. Robert E. Lee. And I, he noticed. But, you know, because it was a very kind of, they didn't want to say miss anybody in those days. If you were pregnant, you had to be married.
Oh, that's right. Sam Edwards, what are you doing these days now?
Well, let's see. The last thing I did in pictures was Coffeeville, which was a Western about the Dalton gang, and I think that's on this week. I didn't have too big a part in it, but I worked in it for about 7 or 8 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did a thing called Requiem for a Nun with Sarah Miles. I played the governor of Mississippi. That was just released here. That's on educational TV.
Mm-hmm.
That was released last week 3 times. So I saw it, and usually I hate myself on the screen. I don't like to look at anything because I'm always disappointed. But I was determined to look at this one because it was a new challenge for me. I've never played a part like this before, and I would not have cast me in it. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't think I was the type. But I must say that I was, you know, pleased.
Well, most actors probably wouldn't cast themselves in certain roles. I think
no,
an objective view, someone else.
The things that I would cast me in, somebody else is casting. The parts that I want, I don't get. Yeah. But I was rather pleased with this. It probably will be played some more. And then I just came back from Tucson. I was there a couple of days doing a Honda commercial. This was about 3 weeks ago. And that was very nice. That should be coming
out.
Did you
have to ride a Honda all over the
place? No, I didn't. I do ride motorcycles, so I have a little Benelli, a little Italian motorbike, which I ride around trying to save gas and so forth. plug for Mr. Ford. So then I recently I did an off-camera voice for Burger Chef hamburgers, which should be released soon.
You did?
Yeah.
Because I did an off-camera thing. Why didn't we work together?
I don't know, but there were about five or six men on this, and some of them I didn't know at all. Harrington, Pat Harrington.
You're doing lots of things, too.
Well, I'm doing a lot of voiceover things, and I have some commercials going, too. I did a series for a while with Tony Franciosa called Valentine's Day, but that was some time ago. Now I'm mostly doing commercials. I have one out for Home Savings.
Yes, I saw that. Yeah.
And I do cartoons. I do Addams Family, which is the most recent one. I do.
Now, when you say you do cartoons, you don't draw them.
No, I beg your pardon.
Voices,
I'm glad
right?
you asked that question because I do provide the voices. I couldn't draw anything. I provide the voices for a cartoon series called Addams Family, which is on Saturday mornings, and I do all the female characters in that, including Morticia, darling, you know, and which was played by Carolyn Jones.
Yeah.
And I play Granny in that, too. You know, she's an old battle axe lady. A typical old battle. And I do a number of cartoons for... I do Josie and Josie and the Pussycats. Judy Jetson, that's been done some time, but they're still playing that. I'm very big on Saturday morning.
You're great on Saturday morning.
Well, they play a lot of cartoons.
We talked to Fred Flintstone a little while
ago. Did you? I do the mother-in-law of Flintstone.
Oh, listen, I've got to tell you this. Alan's son, Alan Reed Jr., was the producer of the Honda commercial that I did.
Oh, he's a good actor, too.
Yeah, I know he is. He's a very good actor. Very nice fellow, too. Very nice man. Very considerate and kind. And knows what he's doing.
Well, Alan Reed Sr. is, of course, Fred Flintstone.
Yeah, that's right.
And you worked with him then.
Yes, I worked with him on the Flintstones many times. And, of course, he also worked in the Jetsons and many of the other cartoons that I worked on. But he's the best known for his Flintstone part. And I played the mother-in-law in that, which is a really old battle axe lady.
Say, now, before I forget, when you get back to Chicago, tell Joe Slattery I said hello.
I will do that for you.
We're on the board of directors of AFTRA.
Right.
And he's a good tennis player, and we were going to play in Denver last year, I think, but something happened. There was no time or something.
Joe's a good man.
Tell him to bring his racket if we go to
tennis
Hollywood, Florida next summer, and I'll bring mine, and maybe we can have a game.
Okay. But Janet, I want to ask about your voices. You're doing all these voices now. Were you interested in using your voice that way when you were Corliss Archer?
In radio, we're very aware of voices, of course, and we did do occasionally doubles, but not too often because we were usually signed for the one voice.
Right.
Once in a while I'd get a chance to do a double, but I think I just kind of discovered voices when I did the Jetsons. I was hired as Judy Jetson, as the voice of Judy Jetson, and everyone I worked with was doing other voices, and so I thought, hey, I bet I could, you know. Mm-hmm. So then I tried, and then I tried a little harder, and I did. which reminds me, I do Penelope Pit Stop on The Perils of Penelope Pit Stop. it's a female Perils of Pauline, you know.
How do you do that without popping your peas?
It's not easy. But anyway, I work with Paul Lind, who is a marvelous, marvelous performer, and he does a lot of cartoons amongst his other many things.
You know, you could easily have gone, both of you, I think, you could have easily have gone into the television version of Corliss Archer because where sometimes the radio...
You see, that's where they made their mistake.
That's
we
right.
Have. Well, actually,
so
do you want to know,
because you do look, both of you, like you could have been Corliss and Dexter.
Well, we could have.
Listened and I'm not disappointed.
But you want to know, actually, they did kind of think about using us, but my agent at that time, can you believe this, and he's still a good friend, but he's given up agenting, and I'm glad, for his sake and for mine, because he thought that I had played Corliss Archer on radio and that I should not do another teenager. And he didn't want me to do it. He wanted me to, you know, progress to dramatic roles and do something really exciting, like go to Broadway or something.
Well, if you were going to be pregnant again, it wouldn't have worked. I'm sorry. No.
But as soon as I stopped playing teenagers, I stopped being pregnant. But the only thing is, he didn't want me to do it. But I really would have loved to, and I think that... we all made a mistake by not doing it, Sammy.
Well, who can tell? You know,
we're going to prove to our listening audience that Meet Corliss Archer could be just as much a hit today on radio as it was in those
early days.
We've got a script around here someplace.
All right.
Got a scene there?
Got a scene from Meet Corliss Archer.
If we don't do it right the first time, can we have a second take?
No, this is live and in person here.
Okay.
So now we're going to set the scene.
Now remember, we're doing this just like radio. No pre-rehearsal.
Nothing.
Cold
reading.
If we make a blooper, you'll have to accept it, audience, because that's the way it was in radio.
Well, apparently, let's see, prior to this, we had a spat of some kind, I assume, and...
We were always making up.
Now
right?
we're making up. Okay.
Okay. Well, let's make up.
Right.
Okay.
Gosh, it's good to be back together again.
Oh, yeah. I missed you, Dex.
I sure missed you.
We'll never have any more fights, will we, Dexter?
No, Corliss.
Oh, I love you too much to fight with you.
Me too. Corliss...
What, Dex?
Corliss, when you went out with Morton, you didn't let him kiss you, did you?
Oh, of course not, Dexter. He didn't even try.
The dope?
Oh, Dexter.
Well, speaking of kissing...
Sure, Dex. Here.
Holy cow. Betty Campbell could never kiss like that.
What? You mean you kissed her?
Oh, now, Corliss, I didn't say that. All I said
was... Oh, you beast! You philander! I never want to see you again as long as I live!
Oh, no!
See, it's a hit today, too.
Gosh, I didn't think I could do that.
Oh, but you did it great.
Well, it's really been fun to meet Corliss Archer and Dexter Franklin and the person of Janet Waldo and Sam Edwards. I thank you very much.
Well, we thank you, Chuck. It's our pleasure.
It was fun. We loved it.